We are celebrating International Women's Day today with a slightly different take on the battle for women to receive equality in the workplace by looking at how it's changing in Japan. Perhaps one of the last places you'd expect to see equality, but with an aging population, they do need as many people as possible in the workforce. We talked to an Australian who is helping drive change over there. Melanie Brock joins me this week.
The Morning Call from NAB with Phil Dobby.
The Weekend Edition.
So to mark International Women's Day, let's talk to an Australian who has been flying the flag in Japan, in a country where you might think there's a much less open attitude to gender equality. But that might just be a huge assumption on my part, although I did read a piece from her in the AFR last year saying that Japan is the lowest ranking G7 country in terms of gender equality. So is that changing? Let's talk to Melanie Brock about her experiences. She's helped many Australian businesses wanting to invest in Japan. That's what she's doing day to day. She's been working in Japan for 25 years, so she speaks the language, has the business and political connections, and she understands the culture. And she's recently been appointed to the board of Asahi Group Holdings, who are now the owner of Carlton and United Breweries. This is her fourth appointment in Japan, the others being Kawasaki Heavy Industries, Mitsubishi Estate, and Sega, the Grand Games Company. So great to have you on, Melanie. The board you sit on, I am assuming that they are very top-heavy with men. I think I read that there are 200 listed companies without any women at all on the board. So it sounds like a very difficult environment for women with ambition.
You know, thanks, Phil, for having me on. And when you're reading out my bio, I was starting to feel a little exhausted just listening to things as they've been described.
It sounds exhausting.
Yeah, it is a very challenging place in many ways. Potentially, Australia has had a head start in setting targets and getting more women and more diversity on their listed boards over the last few years. But I do think there's transformation taking place, albeit at a very sort of slowish pace. But all of those boards that I'm on the Asahi board as of the AGM at the end of this month. But all of those boards have women in both the non-executive director roles and also in the non-executive auditor roles. So we are seeing a change, but to my mind, that's probably not happening fast enough.
Yeah. And is it across all types of roles? Because you look at, not necessarily on the boards, but you look at the management roles within companies. Even now, very often you might say, well, there's a HR person. You know, it's the soft skills that are given to women, whereas the jobs like actually making stuff and deciding, like, for example, car manufacturers in Japan, women buy cars as well as men, but it's often seen as being a male choice. So, I mean, are we a long way from having a car company with a female CEO, for example?
That's true. I think I saw it recently described as the R roles. So that's HR, IR, PR, et cetera, et cetera. They're the roles that women naturally are assigned. That means that they, for example, are not necessarily shining or at least having a chance to do what they might in, say, you know, sales or marketing or frontline roles, as you say, in some of the product development or engineering, et cetera. And so that means that, of course, that women aren't getting those, getting experience, getting a run at different stuff. And therefore, when people say, you know, maybe we should look at appointing a new sales manager, they're less likely to choose from the women cohort simply because they don't have enough women who have that experience. So, you know, it's really a time for the HR division within Japanese companies to take that risk and to start developing pathways for younger women who want to, as you say, be ambitious and take on different roles within a company.
Yeah, because I'm sure women are very good at those R roles. I mean, that whole nurturing and the ability to reason with people, perhaps women are better at that than men. But you would want to see women taking a more diverse sort of job within a company, wouldn't you? Anywhere in the world.
Anywhere in the world. And I think that's the point. It's very easy to look at Japan and on the basis of the stats that we see and also just because of the situation, to make sort of a statement about how backward Japan is or how far behind Japan is. And no doubt in you know, if we look at the World Economic Forum stats or the findings, Japan is always at the very lower end of women in society, but also women in politics, for example. But when you look at the actual purchasing power and or the economic sort of engine within a family, most of the decisions, for example, I don't know, which car a family might in fact purchase, where they might holiday, how they spend their discretionary income, all of those decisions are mostly made by women. And so I think there's been a slight shift at the heads of some of those sort of more product development-based companies looking at how they provide services for women and or products. And they're now getting more women on board to physically be involved in the product development process so that they don't miss out on some of these purchases that are being made by Japanese women after all.
Yeah. So is it, what's driving the change then in Japan? I mean, you're saying, you know, it's slower than the rest, but it is changing. So is it enforced change? Is it cultural change? Are quotas being used, for example? How much of it is regulation and how much of it is just, you know, a desire to actually see that change?
Look, it's tricky. Because, you know, the culture of Japan or society in itself is very much based on the mother and or the wife being at home, looking after the children, raising the children, etc. So, you know, to bring about that Titanic move around is going to be something quite remarkable. But we have Japan responds to external influence when change is to take place, and sometimes it calls on that external influence. And in this case, I think some of the institutional investors, the overseas investors, have said, look, we simply don't want to see boards that don't have a diverse makeup making decisions and or, you know, the corporate governance structure that you have doesn't suit. So we demand that you have a greater a number of women, for example. I think some institutional investors are calling for more diversity simply beyond gender. But so I think it's external, but I think in many cases it's economic. And that's the point that I try and make to Japanese companies, is that for many people now, those traditional roles are not those that people see themselves in, and they want to be able to participate in a company and be involved in the decision making and the strategic development of that company. I think it might be Japanese women's time in the sun. But how long can they wait for that?
Yeah, and how quickly is all that changing? Because I've got this vision in my mind, and it's an entirely sexist vision, but it's the vision I've got of how Japan operates. If I was going to meet a company in Japan, I would be greeted by a fairly subservient Japanese woman who would be bowing and be very pleasant and take me to the room where the men do the business. Is that a view that's very out of date, or is it still a bit like that now?
It's not out of date, because it could happen yesterday, and it could happen tomorrow. And in fact, I find myself in that position now quite a lot. I'm the woman that's being guided to the meeting room by the women, and then the women are bringing me tea. And so, of course, that doesn't sit with me other than the fact that I know that those roles are also highly regarded. The women working in those roles sometimes work there and then move around within the company. So I'm hoping that their managers are looking after them, and that's my sort of only wish for them. But I do think that we're seeing change. And like with a lot of things in Japan, we don't know enough about how Japan ticks. We sort of like to remember we have these stereotype-based views of Japan. And a lot of it, I think, comes from when many people were visiting Japan in the 80s, when it was really, you know, moving, you know, quickly, and it was in the bubble period, as it's described. And I think that the changes that have taken place in Japanese society might not be seen by many of us, simply because people haven't been here. They've been potentially in China more or in other parts of Asia. And so some of the changes that are taking place, or that transformation that I think we see, albeit at an incremental pace and phase, might be things that interest us a little bit about our own countries and how we manage a so-called post-industrialized democracy, I guess. For example, if I look at automation, and this is something that I've learned through my very short time on the Kawasaki Heavy Industries Board, you know, Japanese people don't have the fear of robots, for example, that I think a lot of us in the West have, that the robot is coming to take our job. The robot is going to take away from us the capacity that we have to perform within a company, et cetera. Whereas in Japan, robots are seen as something that supplement the work that's being done or even assist where people simply can't do that role anymore. So I think there are slight changes to the way that the society plays out here that will mean that hopefully, and I know I sound like Pollyanna here, I hope this augurs well for Japanese women.
Well, it seems like things are changing. I was just looking at a graph from the Brookings Institute comparing female labour market participation by age over the years for the USA versus Japan. And it used to be the case that participation a few decades ago dropped to about 50 or 55% amongst women in their mid-20s to mid-30s. Now that dip happens later, of course, as you might imagine, but it only dips to 70% or so, and for a shorter time period. It's now actually very close to where America was several decades ago. So something is changing, whether it's the attitudes, whether, you know, more provision of childcare, or as you say, the companies are being forced to take on more women, or it's education, or it's more determination by women. So it is changing, clearly.
It is. You know, a lot of those roles are in less than the taxation structure doesn't allow, or it allows a deduction against the man or the head of the household, as it were, for a certain amount. And so women work, get that deduction against their spouse's tax.
So the taxation, that's after they've had children, you're talking about the taxation structure.
Married as a spouse, there is the taxation deduction. And it's tiny, but at the same time, I've got two grandchildren here in Tokyo, and my daughter-in-law has to pick up the little one from kindy, and then my grandson is in second year primary school, and he walks home from school like all Japanese primary school kids. But I tell you, the very short hours that she's able to put my little one, our little granddaughter, into kindy means that she would have to have a very, very flexible workplace. She drops her off at 9:30, and then on some occasions has to pick her up at 12:30. So there's little post kindergarten childcare for those kids. So it's simply the structural issues and the societal issues, plus probably the cultural issues, make it such that people are more likely to be in those irregular type of roles simply because the flexibility can then be brought
in. Historically, I mean, the idea was that you'd work for one company for life. Is that still the way in Japan? I mean, I've got this theory in my mind, actually, that one of the reasons we haven't seen wage inflation experienced quite so much in Japan than it is elsewhere is because you work for the one company and you've built up more loyalty to it. But that's a separate issue. But what does it also mean for women? Because if you take a break, if companies used to having people working for them for all their life, if a woman says, well, I want to take a break because I'm going to have children, then that sort of upsets the model a little bit, doesn't it?
Well, it does. And, you know, not just then, but then, you know, the husband's parents are unwell, and is it the wife's role that therefore means that she takes a leave or leaves the job, for example, to look after her parents-in-law, her parents? What pressure is on her? You know, that's where I believe there needs to be great change. Simply, you know, the companies need to change dramatically such that they can allow for women to have a role over and above what the male counterpart might, even with the great pressures that they have on their their family life. Because as you say, you know, if somebody joins, and I work with Japanese companies where it is quite normal and natural to have somebody say that they've been in the business for 30, 35 years, you know, they joined, in 1982 or something like that. And you know, as an Australian, it's so foreign because we're used to moving when we need to, and that flexibility is built into the system. But in Japan, there's still that very conservative base.
It's not necessarily a bad thing, is it, in some ways?
To be admired, and, you know, in the pandemic, of course, that's one of the reasons why people, they weren't laid off to the same extent as they might have been in Australia or the States, for example. So you do have a lot of things where the company provides protection. It's sort of like a family in many ways, but it does put a lot of pressure on people if they are not bound or supported in the same way that they would expect as others have been, for example.
So with all of that going against you, you know, structural and cultural, are you actually seeing any women getting to the top of Japanese companies? Are there many CEOs, for example?
Any. And I think, you know, I just read about another deputy within the Japanese banking sector who's been appointed. It's the first deputy CEO role for any of the mega banks. That's just happened today. And of course, earlier in the year, we saw the appointment of Ms. Tottori, who will in April, from the 1st of April, become the CEO of Japan Airlines. Now, that's a remarkable appointment for many reasons, but she is also a former cabin attendant, as in a flight attendant. So, you know, that shows that the role of women can be amplified and that corporations see the value of somebody who knows the business in and out and says, you know, and she's got the experience, she's, you know, got the management background, and here she is, the CEO of Japan Airlines.
There we are. That's a fantastic example. They're staying with the one company and making it to the top. I wonder whether we'll see more doing that. But, I mean, it is a problem for women, isn't it? In that there's a declining birth rate. I mean, the pressure is on them, an aging population, a low level of migration. So there's obviously a lot of pressure on women to be in the workplace, but also for women to have children to try and alleviate that shrinking population. So they're being pulled in both directions. They need to have babies and be at work at the same time.
I think the pressure on women is massive. And this is why I guess it's, you know, it's painful really to have male politicians telling Japanese women to have more babies when they simply haven't opened up their ranks to more women in politics. Therefore, they're less diverse than they need be. Less, you know, I'm not saying that they're not nice people. I'm just saying that do they really understand the lot of the average Japanese woman, you know, and family? So I think Japanese women are under a lot of pressure, and both at the, you know, having babies and keeping the population growing stage, but also at the caring for the elderly, because, you know, in 2040, I think it's predicted that, you know, about 4 out of 10 Japanese people will be over 65. So that has massive ramifications for the productivity of Japan. But it also means at a societal level, you know, who looks after all of our old people? It's something that I worry about myself, Phil, given that I'm turning 60 this year.
Right. Ditto. But that's not old, is it? That's still very young.
Oh, that's very young. Oh, goodness me. And might I say that living in Japan is probably my greatest move, simply because at 59, everybody says, oh, but, you know, you're just a spring chicken, and I love hearing it.
It's true, Melanie. We've got to keep on telling ourselves this. So,
exactly.
So, but I imagine you're facing a double challenge. Well, maybe a triple challenge if people think that 60 is old. But, you know, you're in a country where there's 3 million foreigners in Japan out of 123 million.
That's right.
So that's 2.5% of the population. So you're battling through that glass ceiling. But, you know, you're also a woman. And some people would say, well, she's 60. Did you hear she's 60 as well, almost? You're breaking through quite a few glass ceilings here.
Well, all of my boards are conducted in Japanese, so that means that there's another level of complexity that you wouldn't have in Australia, for example, where I'd be operating in English. And I feel like I would probably be able to contribute more. But I do think, I feel very keenly the responsibility to push hard where I am able, such that we increase the number of Japanese women, not foreign women necessarily, but also foreign women, but Japanese women in management ranks. Because, you know, it's not actually helpful if I sit on a Japanese board and I can't, with my colleagues, bring about change such that Japanese women and other diversity groups aren't supported. So I feel that very keen, like I feel that responsibility, but I also think it's a huge opportunity to do that. So I don't feel so much about the glass ceiling. I do think that it's really important that I move as fast as I possibly can too. So that's a delicate balance in Japan, because you have to be masterful, I think, in not pushing too hard the foreign angle.
And not being too aggressive, I should imagine,
yeah,
as well.
And I think that, yeah, I think, and also, you know, I've lived in Japan for a very long time. I'm fully aware that, you know, if someone came to Australia, for example, and started to boss us around, we probably wouldn't like that either. So I try and be as collaborative and cooperative as possible, but pushing where I see that there might be change. But, you know, we had an interesting example the other day in one of the board meetings. I said that, you know, we were talking about diversity and whether we needed to, in fact, go big and, you know, how we might do that. And I said that I felt that that the most we could hope for is incremental change and that we must keep that pace up. And one of my male colleagues said, absolutely not. He said, honestly, given all of the demographic challenges that Japan has and all of the research that we know that shows that women are well educated in Japan, that they are capable, that they're committed, they're professional, et cetera, he said, unless we make huge strides now, who are we? And he's a gentleman in his early 70s. And I thought that was really interesting that that as much as I say that I take this very this responsibility, he was saying to me, well, go on then, push harder. And
right. That's so interesting, isn't it? Because my final question, we're going to have to leave it. And by the way, we've got to get you back on again, because, I mean, the subject matter that I'd love to talk to you about is, you know, businesses that want to move in or work with Japanese businesses. And I think a lot of our audience would be fascinated by that. But just on that, your last point, is there anything that, you know, Australia can take from Japan? Maybe you've just given an example of, you know, where there's perhaps a bit more ambition for change, perhaps. Is there anything that Australia can pick up?
Well, I think, well, what I would like, you know, sometimes when I've been speaking with women friends in Australia, I've said, you know, what is this backlash towards women, you know, because I think that it can be quite an acrimonious place, the whole discussion around gender. And so, you know, people have said to me that they think it's the backlash that we always knew we would have, et cetera, et cetera. But maybe in Japan, the backlash is, you know, the pace of change is slower, and because of the demographic challenges that Japan is facing, perhaps there's a greater level of acceptance in the end. And there's a great deal of respect for women. That's another stereotype that I think needs to be broken. Japanese society greatly respects women. It's not always afforded the same respect that it need be. But at the same time, I think there might be some lessons from Japan for all of us about how we manage change and how we make that change sustainable. And also what it does in terms of how our partnership with Japan changes as well. That's something we would always be looking for.
Yeah, great. Well, we'll talk more about that partnership with Japan next time we talk. We'll do that in a few months, Melanie, and fantastic having you on today.
Thank you. Thanks for your time.
Isn't she terrific? Melanie Brock there from Tokyo, and that is our weekend edition for this week. I'm Phil Dobby for NAB, back, of course, on Monday morning. I'll see you then. Thanks for tuning in.
The Weekend Edition.